Thanks again for joining us today. We're thrilled to have such a great crowd this afternoon, and we have another call at 8 o'clock tonight. We hope at the end of the call, you'll ask some questions or want to learn more about something we might have shared. So please feel free to ask a question at the end. If you have that question, someone else might have that very question as well. But we're thrilled to have such a great turnout. So for those that don't know me, most of you do by now, I'm Stephen Taylor. I'm the president and CEO of the Sjogren's Foundation. We're thrilled to have you here. And before I begin, I also want to introduce Kathy Hammett, who is our Vice President of Medical and Scientific Affairs. Kathy and I will be sharing our presentation today back and forth. And at the end, we'll both be available for questions. I also, before I begin, want to thank all the generous donors that support the foundation, both big and small, that help to make all of these initiatives, along with all of our other projects of awareness and education, continue at the foundation. We couldn't do it without the donations from our generous donors. So thank you to all of you for those donations. So today's call is going to be focused on our medical and scientific initiatives. We wanted to bring you up to speed on what's happening with medical and scientific initiatives, because surely COVID has hit us, but it has not slowed us down on our work. We are continuing to work on these initiatives even before COVID and through COVID. And we wanted to share with you a number of initiatives in detail. But first, I wanted to share just a quick overview of some professional education and professional awareness that the foundation does regularly. So first, as many of you know, we have our Sjogren's quarterly newsletter, which is our newsletter that's free of charge to any healthcare professional or technician, dental hygienist, eye tech, whatever they work in the medical field, free of charge. It comes out 4 times a year, filled with great medical and scientific information. Last year, we reviewed over 100 medical research articles in our newsletter. We reviewed them. We also had 8 featured articles last year, along with other great information written at a very high level for physicians and researchers. Patients can subscribe for that for $20 a year, and you can go online and look for that subscription as well if you're a patient. But doctors can sign up by calling our office and or filling out a form online, and they can get that for free of charge. We're continuing to work with awareness ambassadors to increase education among our doctors by sending our awareness ambassadors out to their offices. I won't spend time on that today, but we always are looking for more volunteers. You can go online and learn about that. We just launched back in December, we did a CME education program for doctors. CME stands for Continuing Medical Education Programming, where doctors every year have to get so many credits to keep their license. Sometimes they're specialized credits, sometimes they're general credits. Our program for many of the doctors would be general credits, but it is a free course that's available online now. We did it live in Boston for 800 primary care physicians that attended. We have now have it online on, and it is available for doctors to go see and view at PRIMED. PRIMED is the sponsoring organization that is hosting the CME course and giving the credits, but it is free of charge. We did announce this to all the doctors in our database, and we'll be promoting other ways as well. But it did just get online back in March, and we are able to announce it officially now to our database, although already 1,500 doctors have taken it before we announced it, which is excellent. We obviously attend many conferences, we're on many coalitions, and we're on huge international initiatives to change the face of Sjogren's in the research and scientific fields. And we don't have time to go all into those today, but in future calls, we might spend some time on that. On the next slide, you'll just see a kind of a sampling of our various materials. On the right-hand side, you'll see our new design, Sjogren's Quarterly, although it's been around a while. We just redesigned our Sjogren's Quarterly. That's that newsletter I mentioned for doctors and researchers and dentists. In the middle, our patient education fact sheets that get printed in every Sjogren's Quarterly. There is a new patient education fact sheet for doctors to use. But they are available on our website. After they get published in Sjogren's Quarterly, they are on our website under resources and brochures. And we have about 25 to 30 patient education sheets on all different things. So I encourage you to go to our website and look at those different topics that we have. Everything from sun in Sjogren's to joint pain in Sjogren's, sex in Sjogren's, OBGYN issues, dry eye tips, dry mouth tips, skin issues. So many great fact sheets on that page. Then we have our clinical guidelines we're going to talk about a little bit later. And to the left-hand side, you'll see our Living with Sjogren's Burden of Illness Quality of Life Survey we did a couple of years ago. That is also on our website. You can look at the data that came out of that. So today, the agenda is on our next slide, which you'll see what we plan to go into detail today on specifically. So we're going to spend some time on our clinical trials consortium work. We're going to spend time on ICD coding changes that just happened through the work of the foundation. We're thrilled you'll hear more about what ICD coding is, as well as why it's so important. Clinical practice guidelines, how we're changing the face in regards to how patient doctors treat and manage your disease. And then finally, we're going to briefly end with some information on research funding and support, how we support research and support around the country and the world, really. So the next slide will start off with our first topic, which is a clinical trials consortium work. So back a few years ago, we put together an international clinical trials consortium to bring together the key opinion leaders from the United States and Europe to discuss what the foundation could do to advance and speed up the development of a biologic for the disease. Our goal is we want a systemic therapy for Sjogren's because patients need a systemic therapy to treat the entire disease. We don't necessarily, although we will take another dry eye drug, another dry mouth drug, they're important, but there is no systemic therapy for your disease. And so we are focused, laser focused on that. And that's why the Clinical Trials Consortium was born. These international group of key opinion leaders were then helped introduce the foundation to a number of companies that had been working in the autoimmune disease space, but not necessarily in Sjogren's. So back about 2012, Kathy Hammett and I were introduced to these companies, and we went out and started building relationships with companies to interest them in Sjogren's, to see if they had an interest, see if we could make them interested in it, share with them the burden of illness, how our patients needed and deserve a drug because it was an unmet medical need right now, and that it would be a good investment for them to look at investing in Sjogren's. We're very proud today. There's about 11 companies in clinical trials for Sjogren's. Nine of them are members of our clinical trials consortium. They attend the meetings along with our key opinion leaders to share information about their trials, share their learnings, and share what's gone on with them. So we're very excited about our clinical trials consortium. I'm going to turn it over to Kathy Hammett. To kind of talk a little bit about some of the deliverables and what we've done with this consortium and how instrumental it's been in the space of designing a therapeutic. So, Kathy?
Yeah, thank you, Steve. And hi, everyone. So I'm Vice President of Medical and Scientific Affairs for the Sjogren's Foundation, and I am also a Sjogren's patient. So I have really devoted my career to making a difference in Sjogren's. I don't know about you, but I personally spend a huge amount of time just trying to maintain the status quo with my Sjogren's by using all of the over-the-counter products and other things that I have to do. So wouldn't having a drug that attacked the cause of this disease be an absolute lifesaver for all of us? So as Steve mentioned, we bring industry and international leaders in Sjogren's together around the table. That community was not getting together before we formed the consortium. So we got everybody talking and interacting on a regular basis. And one of the things that I love the most about my job is really listening to patients and also listening to and brainstorming with our medical and scientific leaders so that we figure out where the needs are and that we use our foundation's limited resources and staff to make progress that matters. So this means that we've taken on a lot of initiatives that most groups like ours just don't usually tackle. But we asked ourselves not why should we address them, but why shouldn't we be taking these on? So one of those first elements, if you can go back a slide, Ben, one of those first elements was looking at criteria. And that means how do we define a patient who has Sjogren's? So we got the internet. There were quite a few different sets of criteria floating around, and everybody's got to be defining the disease in the same way. And because there were multiple copies of criteria floating around, people tended to say they didn't want to listen to somebody else who might have approached Sjogren's a little differently. So we started by gathering everybody at the table, and at first everyone came grudgingly to the table, and they were like, well, bah, humbug, you know, I'm right. I don't want to listen to other people's ideas. Then the next time we brought them to the table, we heard, well, okay, I'll listen. And then finally, oh, I can see a solution here. We can all work together. And that was the idea that Steve and I had in bringing everybody together to make sure everybody was using the same definition of Sjogren's. Companies felt there was no market in Sjogren's, so we really had to start a major educational campaign with companies. And then since there was no success story of a drug getting through the systemic drug getting through the FDA, we had to become a full partner with the FDA and really start a dialogue, discuss the challenges of clinical trials with them, and get their input on things. Because if a trial fails, we don't want it to be because the design of the trial was wrong, because that means the therapy could have worked and now it's off the table. So the clinical trial design is really critical. So part of putting a clinical trial together is having what is called as outcome measures. And that means, how do we define whether a therapy is working or not? So let's take a really simple example. Probably most of you have gotten a Schirmer's test for dry eye. This could be an outcome measure. So you measure your tear production before you start a new therapy, and then you measure it again after you have a therapy. And that way you can say, yeah, the therapy was working for the dry eye, or it was not. Fatigue, that's a little more complex, but there are good measures out there for that. So current endpoints also need investigators to rate things the same way. So we took on developing an online training program so that those conducting trials would understand how to score things and how to be trained in the same way. And we now have companies using that program to train their investigators. They take a test and they get certified. And then the final thing is we needed biomarkers in Sjogren's. So what is a biomarker? It's a biological marker, such as a protein in the blood. So for example, if you were tested for anti-SSA or RHO to be diagnosed with Sjogren's, that's a biomarker. And these biomarkers can mean different things. Maybe they demonstrate that you definitely have Sjogren's. Maybe they say, well, with this marker, you're at risk for these specific complications, but not for these others. What we hope is that the markers can change with the clinical trials so that we can see if the new therapy works for those. And also they can be used to identify a specific group of patients. So that's called a subset. So then we can tell that a therapy might be good for this subset of patients, but not for another subset of patients. And that's what's known as precision medicine. So you've probably heard that term. And we've been partnering with the Foundation for the NIH to work on new biomarkers. So I'm serving on the committee for the Sjogren's biomarkers group. And we also decided to join the cancer biomarkers group because they've been focusing on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and multiple myeloma, which can come with Sjogren's. So on the next slide, I look at the next steps. And I'll just say that I'm so excited about our online training program. We called it the Sjogren's Training and Education Platform, or STEP. And as I said, it's now being used by companies to train their investigators. And we can use this to train on all kinds of outcome measures. So we are also working hard on developing new measures that are better than the ones that we currently have. So we have a project going with the Europeans called Necessity. And then we have another one that's chaired by our medical chair and based in the US, but includes representation from around the world, called OMERACT, or Outcome Measures in Rheumatology. And that group is experienced in developing measures in rheumatological diseases. So they've got a good track record. And we can train everyone on all clinical testing through STEP. And just as importantly, how to read that test. So if you've gotten a lip biopsy, you know, not only does someone have to know how to do that properly, but when they send it to a lab, one lab might read it differently from another lab. So it's going to be very important for us to offer training on all of these things so that people are trained consistently and by experts. I had mentioned the biomarkers already. And then finally, companies need places with expertise in the right patient populations to do their clinical trials. So we are trying to increase their success for that. And as Steve mentioned, we now have 11 companies either in clinical trials or about to go into clinical trials. So that's very exciting. Steve?
Thanks, Kathy.
You're muted.
Nope, I'm unmuted. Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate that. We are also excited. So our clinical trials work has led into a lot of different initiatives. And one we identified, besides many of the other initiatives that we started with the clinical trials initiative, was we needed to change our ICD coding in the United States. The ICD coding is a coding system that some of you are familiar with, but it's a coding system that healthcare providers use for diagnosis. It's the charts that they mark when you're in their office for health insurance and health insurance reimbursement. We're very excited that the ICD coding changes that we suggested are going to take effect in October 2020. It will continue into the next update for ICD coding, which is called ICD-11. Right now they're on ICD-10. This is the codes that are pushed out to all the doctor's offices. Every couple of years they update them and it populates the electronic computer systems that doctors' offices and health insurance companies use. So we are very proud of our work. The Center for Disease Control and the American College of Rheumatology joined us in this effort. We launched this effort, Kathy and I did, along with Dr. Alan Baer from Johns Hopkins, to make a change in this coding because they weren't tracking Sjogren's patients correctly. And it was very hard for us to get a number on Sjogren's patients as well as the various manifestations that patients suffer from. So on the next page, you'll see just a little bit more of why we needed to change it. First of all, we were falling under a category called SICA syndrome. And SICA is a symptom, not a disease. We are different than that. So Sjogren's is a totally different disease. The coding was inaccurate and didn't reflect the disease because it didn't capture some of the manifestations. And so many other challenges we know with delayed diagnosis, doctors not knowing the disease well enough, so they didn't even know that certain manifestations were part of the disease. So by changing some of these codes, we were opening the eyes to these physicians about the various manifestations. And then it'll help us and aid us in understanding the true prevalence, as I mentioned, and also help researchers on numbers and health-related costs long-term for the disease. On the next slide, you'll see the new the categories that were listed. So Sjogren's is now the main heading. We added a number of new complications, and you'll see the list that will now be a subcategories. We added 7 new complications to the ICD coding list. So everything from inflammatory arthritis to muscle pain, lung involvement, gastrointestinal involvement, central nervous system, vasculitis, et cetera. These are very important. One important one that looks minor to some people, but very important for us, was dental involvement. The reason being is dentists don't use ICD coding, at least the medical coding. And so we wanted to make sure doctors were paying attention to dental involvement on the medical side of the house. We also might be able to have some data here to start to make the argument long-term. This is a long argument. We've been trying it for years, but we need more data showing the dental involvement in the medical side of the house, so we can show health insurance companies that the dental problems that you suffer from are caused by a systemic disease. And so that's a minor change, but very important long-term for research. The others are so important for the regular care. And by having these on the ICD coding, as I mentioned, the doctors will see this whole list now under the Sjogren's code and realize that Sjogren's is more than just dry eye and dry mouth. Although still very prevalent, dry eye and dry mouth, we know many of you suffer from a number of these. Now there are, I'm sure you'll have a question, why isn't XYZ there? Why isn't ABC there, et cetera? We had a fight to get these. Some got not approved and some did. And so we had to show evidence why we wanted these involved. And so we took what we could win with, we took what we could get for the win, and we'll go back and maybe edit these later on to add additional ones if necessary. But for now, this was a huge gain for the disease, and we're thrilled with this effort. I will tell you that when we called the organization that oversees ICD coding, the person that was making this decision Googled in SICA syndrome, and it came up, and she said on Google, it says it's the same thing as Sjogren's. And thus we had a fight with her, with Dr. Alan Baer from Johns Hopkins, who's an amazing rheumatologist, world-renowned Sjogren's expert, who had to explain to her that just because Google says something or Wikipedia, that doesn't mean it's actually correct. And also we needed to school her a little bit on what the disease actually does to a patient. And so It took a little bit of a fight, but we were able to get it through. I'm also very proud that we were able to get the American College of Rheumatology on board with us on this. I will tell you what's also most remarkable is the American College of Rheumatology. I will back up a little bit. Typically, trade associations like the American College of Cardiology for cardiologists or the American College of Rheumatology for rheumatologists or other associations for other specialties are typically the ones that advocate for ICD coding. So we partnered with ACR. We brought them in because we wanted this change. They were in favor of that we were very happy to hear they were in favor. We didn't know if they'd join us. And then lo and behold, we get our changes. Actually, we win the fight to get the changes. We find out that ACR has never been successful in psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, or any other autoimmune disease ever to have an ICD code change win. So we were the first win for ACR with this change. So we're very proud that we were leading that fight along with Dr. Baer and other rheumatologists that we brought in to this change. That will change the way we're able to code and track the disease, which will help with clinical trials, but also help with the awareness and education of the disease. The next project we want to talk about is clinical practice guidelines. So I'm going to introduce this topic and then turn it over to really the kingpin to this project, Kathy Hammond, who has made this entire project come to life and actually see the light of day. But clinical practice guidelines, many of you have heard me speak about this. You've read about them in our newsletter. But if you're not familiar with them, these are guidelines that kind of a roadmap for your doctor to use to treat and manage and monitor your disease. So, for example, hypertension, high blood pressure. There's guidelines out there for cardiologists and primary care physicians to follow. If you have mild high blood pressure, they look at certain pills for you. If you have a little bit, if that continues and doesn't get cured by those minor hypertension pills, they might put you on this pill. They might put you on that pill as it progresses. They might put you on a multitude of pills. They might try exercise, diet. There's all these things in a roadmap for a doctor to use for hypertension. Same for diabetes. Gout has guidelines. We were the only, lupus has guidelines. We were the only top 10 autoimmune disease that did not have guidelines. What I'm most proud about is we have advocated for the American College of Rheumatology to write these guidelines for over 5 years. We asked them over and over again. We met with them. We talked to them. We begged them. We had doctors talk to them because typically they are the ones that would write it for a disease that their doctors treat. So rheumatologists treat Sjogren's. A rheumatology association would be the ones to typically write them. But they didn't want any interest in doing that. So we decided we were going to start writing them ourselves. So we then we put together an international, not an international, a key opinion group of United States doctors, because these guidelines are for the United States, to come together to really write these guidelines so that they would give roadmaps to the doctors. What happened is as we started to write them, the American College of Rheumatology approached us and asked us, wait, what are you doing? Why are you writing these guidelines? And we said, well, we've asked you for years to write them. So they asked if they could join us. They have been in and out of the process, but they did publish our last set of guidelines, and we appreciate that. And they surely were supportive of our project, but we're thrilled that we were able to do it. We are probably one of two, maybe three patient organizations that have ever written serious patient guidelines for a disease that use the process called Delphi consensus model and grade methodology. We have followed to the T the guidelines for guidelines, yes, that's what you call them, the guidelines for writing guidelines in regards to how they're going to be reviewed and then recognized by peers in the industry. Doctors don't want a patient organization to write guidelines written from patients writing them, what patients think. They need to see the evidence, the science, the clinical experience in these guidelines. And we need to prove, before it gets published, we need to prove to the reviewers that these are serious guidelines that have rigorous methodology behind them and also that doctors voted on them and came to a consensus. That's what Delphi consensus model is. We have to go out to 75 doctors that did not write these guidelines and then make sure that they vote on each guideline. So it's not just the one set of guidelines. It's every line in the set of guidelines need to be voted on. And if 8 of the 10 pass consensus, the last two, we have to go back and either convince people to and show them our methodology and our reasoning, or we have to rewrite them till enough people are comfortable with what we wrote to that they passed consensus. So every single line, you're going to hear about pulmonology in a minute, how many lines, how many guidelines within the guidelines there are, and you will see. Now, it's important because these guidelines are also used for insurance reimbursement. So we want to make sure that we have strong guidelines out there. And then, of course, they're used for research and multiple specialists. go to the next slide, Ben, and I already kind of hinted why this takes so long for a guideline to happen. But the guidelines take so long because we have to use an unbiased, transparent process, no conflicts of interest. We need to use that grade methodology, which means we have to review all the literature that's out there and then decide which literature we're using by a process called grade methodology. And then, as I mentioned, the doctors that we recruit on our committee have to write the guidelines, and then we have to go out to an unbiased group of 75 doctors who will then vote on them. And you'll hear in a minute how much work that takes, but it does take time and effort and funding, and we truly appreciate Kathy Hammett's dedication to this initiative because it was her baby from the start, and she has not slept many nights making sure these guidelines get out as fast as we can make them get out while still being rigorously and recognized and used by doctors. So I'm going to turn it over to Kathy to share the pulmonary guidelines and the other guidelines we've written and where we go from here. So Kathy Hammett. Kathy Hammett, you are muted. So if you are talking, you are muted.
Yes, I'm talking to myself. Thank you.
It was a great presentation, but you might want to start from the beginning again.
Yeah, I was just going to say that just like the ICD coding that we got changed and how that will help physicians take our disease more seriously, it's the same thing with the guidelines. Those will also really help. And a lot of times physicians honestly don't want to see Sjogren's patients because they don't know what to do with us. And having guidelines, having something in black and white and executed the way that they were, makes a physician feel much more comfortable about seeing a Sjogren's patient. So 30 years ago, I think you could have gotten six experts and locked them in a room and told them to come out with recommendations on what a physician would do, unlock the room at the end of the day, and you would have guidelines. But those days are long over, and if you want guidelines to be taken seriously and embraced by the medical community, you really have to follow that rigorous process that Steve was talking about. And all of our people, except for our staff, are volunteers. So all of these physicians are volunteering their time to do this. So pulmonary guidelines, that's our biggest news. We have just completed them. And I won't go through everything that we did to get there because that would take me another few hours at least, if not a few days. But believe me when I say that it was a lot, encompassed a lot of different initiatives. And it included having to woo some pulmonologists over to Sjogren's. So before we started the guidelines, we had one pulmonologist with the foundation. And now we have close to 40 pulmonologists on board with us. And after we publicize the guidelines, we'll have even more. So what I can do is tell you what just our journal submission involved. And that involved, our write-up involved guidance on screening, upper and lower airway disorders, interstitial lung disease, and lymphoproliferative disease. We have 51 recommendations, and each of those has a clinical rationale with references backing those recommendations up. We have five tables and three figures that guide the physician. And then our online supplementary materials are made up of 15 appendices totaling 128 pages, and we have 164 references in all. So that's just to give you a glimpse of what one set of guidelines involves. So you can go on to the great next slide. So as you can see here, we've completed six sets of guidelines, so we're very proud of that. And then we have others waiting in the wings for us to tackle. So you might ask, how do we decide on these topics? Well, we surveyed physicians who treat Sjogren's patients, and we also surveyed patients. We surveyed them at a couple of our national patient conferences and also via blast email. And then we ranked the topics according to the importance to patients and physicians. And then also we had a foundation viewpoint? Like, well, first of all, what was feasible, especially when we were starting these and we had never done them before? What could we actually accomplish? And then also, which topics helped move the field of Sjogren's forward? So for example, you see the use of biologics on here. Well, that was in the top pool, but it wasn't number one. But our group sat down and talked about what a game changer this would be if we actually had guidance on using biologics in Sjogren's. Because this would really show companies and physicians that Sjogren's is serious enough to warrant a biologic, and that over-the-counter products to treat our disease just simply aren't enough. And what was interesting was to see kind of companies' reaction to this, and you saw this huge aha moment for companies when they saw this. So that really helped our clinical trials consortium. So for upcoming topics, we're pulling in neurologists, for example, to look at peripheral neuropathy, which includes autonomic nervous system manifestations. Central nervous system, we have brought in not only rheumatologists and neurologists, but neuropsych, psychiatry, headache specialists, sleep specialists, neuro-ophthalmology. This means bringing, you know, really broadening from our traditional base of rheumatology and oral medicine and ocular medicine. So that is also another benefit of all of these. And next slide.
Kathy, before you jump into the research program, I do just want to emphasize, you know, I mentioned how much work it takes, but what's been really interesting is the education among the cross specialties about the disease. I just saw Pat early mention she went to a pulmonologist recently who didn't even know there was lung involvement in Sjogren's. This isn't uncommon. It's so frustrating. And so that happens in a lot of specialties. You'll go to a gastroenterologist who's never heard of Sjogren's, doesn't know much about it, doesn't know there's a connection. And that's why these guidelines are so critical. But what's also important is the rheumatologists are also learning from the specialists. For example, in the pulmonology guidelines, do you want to share a little bit about how they're learning from each other on that?
Sure. And actually, some of our rheumatologists who really were dying to join the pulmonary guidelines group explained to me because they didn't know what to do with their pulmonology patients. And these are Sjogren's experts. So that was a real eye opener. And then also, what was I going to say? What was really interesting to me was how much I learned. I learned a lot about, I didn't know that the majority of Sjogren's patients will have an abnormal CAT scan of the lungs. So a lot of people out there are subclinical. So this has been a real learning opportunity for everybody. And everybody already approaches things a little bit differently. So it's been really neat to see how different specialists approach things and their interaction and their sharing and their ability to come up with guidelines together. So whereas a rheumatologist wants, for example, to do an x-ray, to have a baseline x-ray, the pulmonologist didn't like that as much because they felt like it didn't show as much. But they understood the rheumatology standpoint that if you are a new Sjogren's patient with a rheumatologist, an x-ray might help on a number of fronts. But then if there's any real suspicion of pulmonary involvement in Sjogren's, you want to move to that higher level CAT scan. So just the debate and the dialogue, we all learned a lot. So you want to prevent patients from getting too much radiation from a CAT scan when you can, but when is it most appropriate? And so all of these issues were debated over and over again. And it's been a fascinating process.
And that's just in pulmonology.
So thanks, Steve.
That's just in pulmonology. You can all
Yeah.
topics have gone on and all the other topics, as well as some of the future ones, have already started meeting. And it's definitely been very eye-opening all around for everybody. So it's quite an extensive process, and we're thrilled to be one of only a couple handful of patient organizations to lead such a huge initiative in any disease state. So Kathy, I'll turn.
Yeah. And the other thing that we will really strive to do is to make sure all the rheumatologists and general practitioners that we really publicize these guidelines with them, but then also we'll be reaching out to pulmonologists and the pulmonology guidelines. So this really gives us a way to reach out to all of these different specialists. And I have to thank our director of research, Matt McCara, who I don't know how I could have made it through pulmonary guidelines without him. So he was like gold. So I appreciate him so much. So I'll go on to research program, if that sounds good to you, Steve. So our research program is near and dear to my heart because care will really only get better when we find answers to all of our many questions about Sjogren's. For example, what causes it? What contributes to our developing it? Can we halt it or reverse damage even once Sjogren's has really taken root? And you really only find that through the basic science research. So we offer research grant awards, and we are now offering a high impact award with a higher dollar amount to really entice people to come up with something really new and different and innovative. And then also pilot awards that help people just start to gather that data so that then they can go on to apply for a grant from the National Institutes of Health. So speaking of the National Institutes of Health, I'll just mention that we do spend a fair amount of time trying to nurture those relationships. The NIH is the largest public entity in the world, and it funds more research than anywhere else in the world. So we want to tap into those millions of dollars for Sjogren's, right? So we're there for advisory council meetings to make sure Sjogren's is seen and heard. I recently have serving on one of those councils, and Matt and I serve on many of their committees. And our advocacy at one of those led to the Institute last fall holding a major program for researchers in Sjogren's. Steve and I both spoke at that. It was a good way to bring researchers together and get them excited. Through that, I was appointed to the Surgeon General's Task Force to develop a national oral health research plan and appointed to an interagency consortium on pain. We want a seat at those tables so that Sjogren's is included and not ignored. And then finally, surveys. Surveys are really important. You're probably familiar with our recent big national Living with Sjogren's patient survey. The information that we can get from these is absolutely priceless for all of us. They show companies that new therapies are needed. They show companies and physicians which symptoms are prevalent and which ones they should be watching for in their patients. Matt has been working with a group of physicians to dive more deeply into that data, and a journal has just accepted the write-up on one of those data dives for publication, and more are in the works. So, Steve?
Thanks, Kathy. And our final comment we wanted to mention before we open it up for questions is there's future advocacy and research issues that we're on top of and that we're always watching, and they come up in all different ways. We obviously jump on everything that's current and important right at the moment. We also table other things that we know we want to get to in the future. We, as Kathy showed you, the future list of clinical practice guidelines is just our list and guidelines. We have lists under every category that we work at the foundation. If you know the staff, we only have 15 staff members at the foundation. We're very strong, mighty, or tiny, but mighty, I always say. But all of them have lists of things. They are never bored in regards to what we need to be working on next to change the face of Sjogren's, make it a household name, and change the diagnosis, the treatment, et cetera. For example, however, I wanted to mention, obviously, COVID-19 brought up many issues, but mostly the hydroxychloroquine, Plaquenil shortage issue for Sjogren's patients was immediately something that we jumped on as soon as that began happening on March 19th when the president started talking about the use of the drug. Surely that did not help with the shortage. We know that the evidence is not showing to work either in preventing the disease and or treating the disease. Most studies are now showing very negative side effects and negative issues with the medication. However, we know that it works in Sjogren's. And I saw there's a question on the chat room, but also I was going to talk about today is we are working on a few initiatives in this area. One is we'll be doing a patient survey just on the use of hydroxychloroquine. We know that 43% of patients currently take the hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil. Plaquenil is the name brand of hydroxychloroquine, which is the generic name. We know 43% of you take that drug. And so we're going to do a survey of how it helps you, what benefits you see from it, and other things we're going to be asking you, because we plan to put out a white paper, a guidance document just on hydroxychloroquine and the use of it. Right now, it's very weak information out there on hydroxychloroquine. The American College of Rheumatology has not taken the lead on helping doctors understand the use of it in Sjogren's. And it is in our guidelines. We've written it to use hydroxychloroquine in fatigue. We will continue to write it in other areas that we know it works for as well. I think it's also mentioned on the musculoskeletal pain guidelines that we have. But we want a white paper specifically just on the use of hydroxychloroquine. There's tons of research out there on the use of it. There are some negative research, but that's always the case in any disease state. There's going to be negative. But when there is more information positive about it than negative about it in the use and treatment in Sjogren's. But also we know, and there was just a recent study that came out that showed the benefits of it as well. We actually have a whole list of all that research, but we are going to be doing that white paper using the background research as well as the survey. So watch for that information. I want to mention real quickly, since we're on that issue, so no one has to ask this question in case you missed other ones of our town hall meetings when I did a COVID update. We are not listed typically on TV when they talk about hydroxychloroquine because we are not an indicated use for the medication. Lupus and rheumatoid arthritis are an indicated use, although we have been being used as an off-label use for over 35 years. To give you a background, hydroxychloroquine, Plaquenil, came about probably about the 1930s or 40s for the use in antimalarial. In 1956 is when they did the clinical trials for lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, literally 1956. So you can imagine that's a long time ago. Now there's been some studies done since then, but it got approved by the FDA then. We started using it in Sjogren's 35 years ago, about 35 or so years ago in Sjogren's. It's been used regularly without any issue. Still is being used without any issue, but they won't be mentioning it probably typically in media because it is not FDA approved for that. It's considered an off-label use. Although the FDA and others know the numbers of Sjogren's patients that take it, et cetera, and we were fighting continuously the month of March and April about the shortage on behalf of Sjogren's patients. And you can listen to the previous COVID town halls to hear exactly what we were doing with the FDA, the manufacturers of hydroxychloroquine, and other groups that we were advocating to, meeting with, and talking with about the use of it in children. So I encourage you to do that. So then the last slide I just want to mention, obviously the foundation is always looking to the future, always working on additional projects. But our vision, as you all know, it's clearly on our website and all of our materials, but is to create a community where patients, healthcare professionals, and researchers can come together to conquer the complexities of Sjogren's. And we know how complex this disease is. It's complex to diagnose, complex to treat, complex to live with, complex to explain, complex to research. And so we are out there in every one of those areas trying to break down those complexities and help the patients in the end. And finally, I just want to end. I mentioned the thank you to the donors that have helped us throughout the years. We appreciate every donation. Obviously, during COVID time, we need support more than ever, but we appreciate $5, $10 all the way up to our large donors that give us large amounts as well. I'd also be remiss if I didn't mention that we, for those that aren't members of the foundation, you can join the foundation for $36 a year, receive our newsletter, which comes out 6 times a year for patients, be invited to town hall meetings, other meetings, as well as get discounts on all of our books and our conferences if you're a member. If for some chance that you are a current member or a new member, you aren't a member, for example, or you are a current member and you've lost your job during COVID, you have a challenge right now financially in your family and your renewal comes, or you want to join and you don't have the $36, we offer scholarships as well. So you just have to call our office. And we will take your information over the phone and put you in the system and give you a free year membership to the foundation. If you're up for renewal and you get your renewal envelope or your renewal email and you are in the same situation as I mentioned and out of work or something's happening because of COVID, we don't want you to go without your information. So please call the foundation office and we can help you. For those that can renew, we appreciate the donation of the $36 and we appreciate any donation that anyone gives us year round. So with that, I'm going to open it up for questions. I know there's been a few questions regarding a few things. I've already talked about the Plaquenil. Someone did mention genes research. We do fund research in Sjogren's, as Kathy mentioned. We do a lot of genetic research in the United States and around the world. We're on a huge international coalition for research. But one of the leading Sjogren's institutions in genetics is out of Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation. It's called the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation. A number of researchers that work there are involved with the organization. You will see an article in our upcoming patient newsletter. Our patient newsletter is now called Conquering Sjogren's, as you know. We will have an article on the updates of gene research in the July-August issue written by Dr. Chris Lessard out of OMRF. So watch for that and you'll get more details on that because OMRF was the first to find genes associated with Sjogren's. Some are associated with lupus and Sjogren's, and then there's ones that are distinct just to Sjogren's that they have found. So please watch the newsletter for more information on that. If you have a question, you can go down on the bottom of your screen. There's a participant tab. You can click on that. It'll open up a screen with a list of participants. You can hit raise your hand. And that will bring you to the top of the queue for a question. You can do *9 on your phone, if not on your Zoom app, but on your phone itself if you've dialed in. And *9, that'll bring you into the queue as well for questions. I do want to mention that the guidelines are all on our website. I did put the link in the chat room. They are underneath the tab at the very, very top of our website. And it says researchers and providers, and there's a drop down, and the clinical practice guidelines are there. So you can print it there. There are the dental guidelines, ocular, and the systemic as well. So you can go there, and we encourage you to print them and bring them to your doctor. I saw someone say, can we give them to your dentist? Of all doctors, please give them to your dentist because dental decay prevention, dentists don't know what they're doing half the time and out there in the communities. And so bring them those guidelines so they can look at those and see what you might need that will help prevent dental decay. So I see we have a question. Pat, do you want to unmute Pat then?
Hey, hi, Pat. There. Hi. Listen, I just texted my geneticist daughter about the TYK2 gene. Mm-hmm. May I read what she responded?
Sure.
Okay, because this is what she works with on a daily basis. I just said, can I have an explanation? This is what she wrote to me. It's a non-receptor tyrosine kinase. There's only 90 out of our 20,000 to 25,000 total genes, which basically means it's a big signaler. Sorry, she's texting more and my thing's moving. It's a big signaler that signals lots of other genes. Specifically, this one signals immune responders, if you will. This gene has a broader reach than most of its kind, so it signals multiple different pathways of immunity. Thus, any change in the gene could affect a different subsector of signaling, creating a different immunity deficiency or result. One of the big immune pathways is the IL-10, which regulates anti-inflammatory response. So you can imagine that a change in TYK2 could cause a haywire anti-inflammatory response, essentially a mutation in TYK2 or even TYK2 signaling can result in immunodeficiency syndromes, which may not present the same in each individual, even if they have the same mutation.
And just that, so everyone listening to that probably can now hear how difficult gene research is. And so thank you, Pat, for reading that for sure.
It's all right. That was a little more technical than I was expecting. Well, that's my kid. That's my kid. She's a geneticist in her genes.
Well, that's a geneticist, and that's genes for you. So people think it's identify one gene, and boom, you've got your research done. And obviously, genes interact with different genes. It's going to be more than one gene for Sjogren's. And then there's other receptors, like she mentioned, TYK, and others that can be caused by deformalities in genes, et cetera. So gene research is very complicated. We're a ways off in many diseases, not just Sjogren's, but in even larger diseases than Sjogren's, more popular, more common diseases, in regards to figuring out what it all means. But we're thrilled to know there's researchers out there doing focused research in Sjogren's for sure. So, but thank you, Pat. I appreciate that. I'm going to ask Kathy Hammett a question that came through the chat room. Kathy, do you want to talk about what the lung scan looks differently in what you know about that before the guidelines come out? You'll see them in the guidelines, but what you know, Kath?
Yeah, sure. But what I first want to say is one of the things that our pulmonologists and rheumatologists stressed is that if you are not suffering from pulmonary symptoms, you really don't want to go to that next step of getting treatment. I think one of the things that I should have known, and I have these should have known moments quite frequently over the years, is that Sjogren's affects every part of the body. And sometimes we don't think about it because we're so focused on the eyes and the mouth. But what's going on, say, with the salivary glands, with the lymphocytic infiltration there, that can either cause damage or you can also have dysfunction. That's going on everywhere. So it's going on in the lungs. So you're getting lymphocytic infiltration and through the mucosa in the lungs. That's what they can see on the CAT scan. And you know, you can also see that in the vagina and other places. So I remembered when I first heard that and I was like, well, of course, duh, you know, this is going on everywhere. But they did stress that what's so important is that maybe the majority of us are subclinical pulmonary. This is going on all through the body, but it's not necessary to get expensive treatment or expensive testing or exposure to more radiation than you need until you're actually suffering symptoms and having problems. So that's part of the fibrosis that's going on everywhere. And when it gets severe enough to actually cause interstitial lung disease, that's when you have to deal with it. So for example, with our clinical trials consortium, we do have one drug finally. It's not specifically for Sjogren's, but it's for progressive fibrosing interstitial lung disease. And that was just approved by the FDA in March. We were very excited. There were Sjogren's patients in their trials, but they say that it's for that complication in rheumatic disease. So if it gets severe enough, then that's when you treat it so that you have symptoms.
Thanks, Kathy. Yes, for sure. I'm glad you're able to share that. And we'll have additional articles coming down the road once the guidelines get it published. We'll be printing the guidelines in Conquering Sjogren's. And of course, we'll have articles on lung conditions as well. We've also last year at a national conference, we had a pulmonologist speak. We've had pulmonologists speak before at our conferences as well. I do want to mention, someone asked regarding autoimmune diseases, they do run in families. Someone asked that question. So a grandmother might have lupus and the granddaughter might have Sjogren's, vice versa. The mom could have Sjogren's, the daughter could have lupus. They do run in families, tend to typically focus on women and females in families. Almost all except about 5 autoimmune diseases skew towards women, meaning 60 to 40% or 70-30, 80-20, et cetera. It does run in families very commonly. So I did want to mention coalitions. Someone asked about work with coalitions. We work with so many coalitions, too numerous to name today, in regards to we work with all autoimmune disease groups that work in our space, especially on the hydroxychloroquine shortage that was caused. We worked with Lupus Foundation, Arthritis Foundation, on coming together with the state insurance boards and governors and the president, as well as FDA. We also work with autoimmune disease groups on all types of coalitions around patient advocacy, step therapy, where step therapy is where you have to go on to step one before they'll move you to step two. Even though the doctor thinks you should be on step four immediately, step therapy insurances are holding people back to make them go through step one, two, three, and then finally go to four, causing possibly more harm to you by not being able to go right to step four. And so we work with a lot of autoimmune diseases, for example, on that issue. We work with NIH, Kathy mentioned NIH, and as well as other institutes, all the institutes at NIH, her, Matt Macara, as well as myself and other staff work with that. And we also work with international Sjogren's groups around the world. We have 29 from around the world that are members of our International Sjogren's Network. We mentor and lead them. We're the only organization in the world that has staff as large as us. There's two countries that have maybe two staff members, but the rest of the world is covered by volunteers. So France's organization is all volunteer run, et cetera. So they look to us to mentor and lead them, and we support them through the International Sjogren's Network as well. In addition, Kathy, you want to talk about the a few things that you saw that came through in questions before today or on the chat?
Sure. Yeah, I saw the question about lymphoma not being in the list on the ICD coding. And that reason is that both the CDC and the CMS, which has the ultimate say-so, said there is a separate listing for different kinds of lymphoma. So if you have that, rather than checking that under Sjogren's, that then you then go to the lymphoma listing for that. There was another question, too, about other medications being developed that are different, say, from the biologics that are systemic medications or small molecule drugs. And actually, there's a lot going on, especially with dry eye and dry mouth, but a lot with dry eye, a lot of drops, different drops being developed, medications that you would put in your eye. There are a lot of clinical trials going on with those things. So we're also involved with all of that. And so, for example, with the dry eye drugs, I just served on the Tear Film Ocular Surface Society International Consortium, which covered every area of dry eye. And we really looked at how to do a proper clinical trial in dry eye, management and treatment, all of those aspects were covered. So I hope that answers your question. Mm-hmm. And then someone also asked what interstitial means. So interstitial lung disease means the fibrosing of the lungs or the scar tissue that develops. We also get scar tissue in our salivary glands and in other moisture producing glands. And that prevents them from functioning as well.
Thanks, Kathy. If there is a question, you can raise your hand on that bar. But I will mention, I did see someone just mention about the national conference, and I was going to end with that. And then we have a question from Sharon we'll bring in. But the National Patient Conference is still going on. We are moving it virtually. So we'll have a virtual conference on Friday, June 26th and Saturday, June 27th. Same dates as we were going to be in Phoenix, but now we'll be virtual. We will be holding it from 1 to 5 on Friday and 1 to 5 on Saturday. We'll have 10 speakers just like we would at the conference, roughly 10 speakers. I should say. We're working on the agenda now, but there'll be almost all of the speakers that we have will be the same ones that were on the agenda for Phoenix. So we're thrilled to be hosting the conference that way. We're thrilled to still be bringing it to all of you. Information on registration will be coming out in another week or so as we're finalizing our vendor and how we're going to be delivering that platform to you. But we're excited to have that. And then your registration will also give you access to those lectures for a time afterwards to go back and re-listen to that. I should say thank you, Eastern Standard Time, 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So that would be 10 a.m. West Coast time they would start each day. I will say to Phoenix folks, if you're listening, we will be coming back to Phoenix. We aren't just because we technically can say we were in Phoenix or going to be in Phoenix. We will still come back with a national conference to Phoenix. So that will be on the short list within the next year or two. We will be back to Phoenix with our national conference so that we don't exclude those residents out there that we know have Sjogren's and wanted to come to the local event. With that, we'll take Sharon in for a question if we can, Ben.
I have a couple of questions if that's okay. Why does it matter so much what we eat? Like the symptoms get so much worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy, I can jump in real quick, but Kathy Hammett can add a few things. We're not medical professionals, but we can tell you a few things. One is your saliva, lack of saliva can cause gastrointestinal issues. And because you have certain properties in your saliva, it doesn't break down the food correctly and can cause gastrointestinal issues like GERD and other issues. So that's one issue. and the lack of saliva, and the things can cause more problems with acidic foods and things like that. And then your dental decay issues can cause other problems just to be able to eat certain foods. So eating potato chips or hard, crunchy things can hurt your teeth, can break off teeth, or can actually hurt your mouth because your mouth is so dry you can get cuts from potato chips, etc. And then there's, of course, the connection with celiac or gluten insensitivity, which is a real challenge as well. And celiac is considered an autoimmune disease. And we know Sjogren's, unfortunately, if anything you want to say that you're popular for, Sjogren's is the most common autoimmune disease to go alongside other autoimmune diseases. So you see a lot of Sjogren's patients with another autoimmune disease, which is good and is good. You can make that exciting news for you, but it's really not, unfortunately. But we do see Sjogren's coincide with so many others, and celiac being one. But you can be non-celiac, still gluten sensitive. But Kathy Hammett, do you want to answer any thoughts?
Well, you covered it well. I'll just add that, most of us have high inflammation levels. So certain foods can increase that inflammation. So in that case, you want to choose foods that are considered anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing is I feel hungry a lot, even though I'm not diabetic and I eat like all the time. Is that pretty common?
Kathy, I don't know if you want to answer. I don't really have an answer. And you know, this forum probably isn't the best. I don't want to call for people to give comments, but I don't know if you're on Smart Patients, but you surely could go on Smart Patients. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Sharon, but Smart Patients is our platform where you can put in a question and people can answer back to you. You can find the links on our website. And that'd be a great conversation starter. And I'll add it to one of our lists to see if a doctor, if that's an answer, a doctor even can answer. I haven't heard that much being around a long time. That people are more hungry necessarily, but I know people are less hungry sometimes, but I haven't heard of more hungry necessarily. Oh, you're muted, Sharon.
The group I'm in, but and just one other question. Yeah. Is low-dose naltrexone a good drug to be using for Sjogren's?
Kathy, do you want to handle that?
We don't have the clinical trials on that. It may be that it ends up being good. I've also heard physicians say that it's one of the best placebos they've ever seen. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know at this point. We don't have the evidence.
Right. We are working on that for sure. So looking more into that. But there's definitely not the data on that, although some doctors are using it. We do know that. So we have it on a list to start to look at as well. But Sharon, thank you. I'm going to move on to Isla. I'm going to take the last two questions real quick. But I know we're a couple minutes over, but Kathy Hammett and I agreed we'd stay a couple minutes, take a couple more questions. By the way, the Smart Patients, Sharon, link is on our chat room. You can go there and find the Smart Patients link to join Smart Patients if you're not, and talk amongst other patients. We have about 5,000 patients on Smart Patients discussing various things. Isla, I think, is next, Ben. Do you want to bring Isla in?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Steve. Thank you so much, you and Kathy, for this. This is great. I wanted to mention, I've listened to some other town hall halls, and they've been wonderful. I've learned so much.
Oh, good.
I have really newly diagnosed with this, and this was in 2018 in October after my doctor decided to do an ANA blood work on me. And it's the first time I had that done, and it showed up that I had that I have an autoimmune disease plus Sjogren's, primary Sjogren's. And I've had other blood work done, same thing, very strong, it shows that. The one thing in the area I noticed though, and I have a wonderful eye doctor that is really up on this, he's really helpful, but it's the rheumatologist in this area that's very difficult. I know it's a challenge for them, but I still do not have a rheumatologist that monitors my work. I have one that saw before COVID-19. He saw me, didn't want to see me again until 6 months, and now it's up to 8 months later because of the COVID-19. And so I have suffered with this for years. That's why I had seen my doctor in 2018 and made a list of things to let her know what was going on, and that's when they did that. So what I'm trying to find out is, I know There's so many answers you've given me just by what you've said. So it looks like it's going to be very helpful with all this coming up for rheumatologists to be able to be better informed and be able to help someone, because it's really hard to go into a rheumatologist's office and have them decide that about decide something else other than what they should decide on. It affects every part of my body, but and I stay with my eye doctor, so I don't know if this is much of a question or as much letting you know that it's still a challenge out here in some areas to get a rheumatologist that wants to work with you, work with the individual.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
Now, Isla, where are you, just curiosity-wise?
I'm in North Augusta, South Carolina,
okay.
Just over the bridge from Augusta, Georgia.
Okay. Yeah, so thanks for the question and comments, Isla. I totally understand. We, you know, a frustration for us is obviously getting enough doctors educated and up to speed on it. I will say, I don't know if, Isla, you had a chance or others to go listen to the telehealth town hall, but we did a telehealth town hall, and it had some great information about doing telehealth and how telehealth, now that doctors are becoming experts on it because of COVID, it could open up opportunities to meet with other experts from around the country without having to travel to them. So you can still keep your local rheumatologist, but consult with an expert at one of the Sjogren's centers around the country or another rheumatologist that's an expert in Sjogren's and meet with them via telehealth and then be able to bring that information back to your doctor as well. They would be able to send it to your doctor after they consulted with you. So that might be an option for some. And some of you are driving distance, although it might be an hour, two, or three to get to a Sjogren's expert. We do recommend that it's worth a try to go to one of them once or twice, once a year, or I was going to say once every other year for that consult in person. And sometimes that's going to take a little bit of a drive. And I know you weren't saying this, Isla, but we do get calls at the foundation. And, you know, if you were diagnosed with a certain type of cancer or a certain type of heart disease or something, you would never hesitate to drive and go to a doctor to wherever you needed to go. And sometimes with Sjogren's, you might have to do a little bit of that as well. And you might have to go a little outside your comfort zone. But now, because of telehealth, financially, it opens it up for even more people. So don't forget those telehealth ideas. I know a number of the clinics are doing them and taking appointments that way. So keep that in mind. So I'm going to jump to, and just so you know, a list of we don't have a list of Sjogren's experts because we've tried it many years. The list becomes outdated, old. Some patients love a doctor, another one hates a doctor. And so it becomes this, people calling us after they went saying, you told me they were going to be great, I hated them. And it becomes bedside manner discussions. But we do have over almost 200 people that take phone calls from patients from around the country. So you can always call the office and find a person that might be in your state or close by that you could talk to. And they could share doctors they know have worked in the area. Also, if you have a local support group, those people in the support group know the doctors in an area. So if you have a support group, going to a meeting just one time, just to say, who goes to who here? What doctors have you found helpful? Which ones have you found useless? That might give you a good list locally as well. So I'm going to bring in E. Bowie, I think it is. Ben, do you want to bring them in? Hello, you're on camera and you are live.
Okay. I just wanted to say to Sharon, I'm hungry a lot too. I do deliberately schedule snacks just like I schedule meals.
Interesting. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And also, hopefully, you can go to Smart Patients as well and maybe start that conversation. That would be great. Oh, you're muted, Eboe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, what were you saying?
I am on Smart Patients a fair amount, and it has been so helpful to me.
Perfect. Thank you. And thank you for that endorsement. I do think patients find great solitude in that and advice from each other. And you can search by a keyword, and anytime that question's been answered in the last few years, it'll pop up with all the answers as well. So I think it's a great resource. I'm going to turn it back to Kathy Hammett for some closing remarks. Before I do, I just want to, again, applaud Kathy Hammett and her dedication. As she mentioned, not only is she a Sjogren's patient, she's obviously our staff at the foundation, but her career in Sjogren's has been remarkable and inspiring and a joy to watch as Kathy has delivered amazing results for our patient population. And I think if any of you have had a chance to meet Kathy in person, you surely know what an amazing inspiration she is. And we truly appreciate all that she's doing on behalf of the patient population. So Kathy, I'll let you say some closing words.
Okay. Well, thank you, Steve. I really appreciate that. And as a Sjogren's patient, I certainly have the passion to see that something gets done. I love working on this. I love seeing progress the most of all, which we have really seen accelerate over the last decade. And so I can't retire because I keep seeing good things on the horizon, and I want to be there and be there and be a part of them all. And I appreciate all of you for participating and listening, and for your interest and your support, and for being in this with us together. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everybody. And if you want to listen again at 8 o'clock, you surely can join again at 8. I think, Ben, the Zoom code is the same for 8 o'clock. So same Zoom code if you want to listen in for questions and see if the different conversation starts. Of course, they'll be this will be recorded and sent out to you as well for taking part this afternoon, so you can re-listen to this. And I encourage you to go to our website and find all of the town halls that we've held in the last couple of weeks on our front side of our website, available for members and non-members. And the first set of series is on our member side of our website. So I encourage you to sign in as a member, and you can find those. But the ones we've done the last few weeks are available to members and non-members, and you can go to our public side of our website for that. So thanks, everybody. Take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye, guys.